Welcome to Main Street on this Giving Hearts Day on Prairie Public and across the state. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Today is a day when communities across North Dakota and Northwest Minnesota come together to support the causes that make this region stronger, kinder, and more connected. If Prairie Public is part of your daily life, if you count on the news, the conversations we have, the music, the storytelling, and the programs that bring our communities together, today is the day you can show that support. And it's simple. There are no phone calls. Just go to prairiepublic.org, where you'll find a direct Giving Hearts Day link on our homepage, or head to Giving Hearts Day and search for Prairie Public. All day long, we're sharing stories about the impact of public media and why your support matters right now. So stay with us. And if Prairie Public matters to you, today is the perfect day to give from the heart. Welcome to Main Street on this Thursday. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and it's time for our weekly series, A Closer Look with the Monitor, where we examine the reporting shaping conversations across North Dakota from the North Dakota Monitor. Today, we're talking about immigration enforcement and the growing number of ICE detention cases now moving through federal court here in North Dakota. North Dakota Monitor reporter Mary Stoyer recently reported that emergency petitions challenging ICE detentions have begun appearing in the state's federal courts, part of a broader national surge tied to increasing immigration enforcement. And Mary, it's a pleasure to have you back with us today to walk us through what's happening, why it matters, and what it could mean for North Dakota.
Hello, thank you for having me.
What's changed nationally, Mary, that's leading to the increase in these detention-related lawsuits?
These lawsuits in North Dakota and elsewhere in the country pretty much all stem from a belief that as the Trump administration pushes to massively increase immigration arrests, detentions, and then deportations, that immigration agents are detaining people unlawfully.
So your reporting notes a 75% increase in ICE detention nationally over the past year. Of course, we've seen a lot of that just in the news that we consume. How does North Dakota fit into that trend?
So I haven't found state-level data that's recent enough talking about detentions in North Dakota over that same time frame. It might be available and I just haven't found it. Although a lot of this data that's coming out of the federal government, there's kind of a lag to it. It takes a while to see what's happening on that granular level.
You do report that 7 emergency petitions have been filed in North Dakota federal court this past year, all within the last 3 months. What exactly are these emergency petitions asking judges to do?
Most of them are asking judges to order ICE to allow these detainees to request bond hearings. So up until fairly recently, if you were an immigrant detained by immigration agents inside the United States and were accused of being undocumented, you could usually request to go before an immigration judge for a bond hearing and potentially be released from detention if you could convince them that you didn't pose a risk of, you know, fleeing or you didn't pose a threat to the public. And this practice came from guidance from the Department of Justice. However, last year, the executive branch came out and said that this guidance was wrong, and they took the position that federal law actually requires these immigrants to be detained basically for the duration of their immigration proceedings. And so, of course, naturally, a lot of people disagree with this stance, and they think that the administration is breaking the law, and so they're filing these lawsuits to ask federal judges to review their cases and to intervene and order ICE to allow these people the opportunity to have bond hearings.
Do we know, Mary, whether the people that you've reported about who have filed these petitions are, in fact, North Dakota residents?
I've looked at the court documents, and it seems like most of them are. If my memory serves me correctly, there was one instance where the individual who was detained in Minnesota, and I think there was one lawsuit where it was ambiguous. I couldn't glean from the documents if they for sure lived in North Dakota. But most of them appear to be people living in North Dakota.
One striking detail, at least it was striking to me, is that the legal system in what you're reporting about doesn't guarantee counsel in these immigration proceedings. That was a surprise to me. How significant is that?
It's my understanding that people don't have a right to representation in civil proceedings, and immigration charges are civil violations. So a lot of these people go unrepresented. And I think that's significant because just of the stakes involved here. And additionally, like, a lot of these people may not speak English or may not speak very much English, let alone understand the law, which, you know, most of us do not. I certainly do not. And navigating immigration laws is extraordinarily complex. So just like most people are sort of at a disadvantage if they don't have an attorney, that could certainly apply here too.
Tell me who Sue Swanson is and how she described all of this, kind of like you just spoke about, learning as she goes.
So Sue is one of the few full-time immigration attorneys in the state. And she says she believes she's the only one admitted to practice in federal court. And so she was the only attorney out of the seven petitions I reviewed who was a North Dakota attorney who brought these challenges to ICE detentions. And it was her first time doing so, she said. That, you know, even though she has practiced in federal court before, this was a very unique situation. And of course, like, with federal immigration policies changing so quickly, she said she had never been in a situation where she had to do this before. And so thus, she said she's been having to learn as she goes.
Mary, you report that federal judges in North Dakota have ruled differently on the question of these bond hearings. And can you explain what changed in federal policy regarding bond eligibility? I think you touched on that earlier, but what is the reason that judges are ruling differently?
So there have been a few different rulings. The main two positions of our federal courts that have kind of diverged is like on the interpretation of the federal laws that dictate what should happen to someone who's been accused of being in the country illegally. And so basically, like, the difference is whether or not the judges agree with the federal government's position. Our judges, Daniel Hovland and Peter Welty, have issued rulings that indicate that they disagree with the federal government's position. And then Judge Dan Traynor, who has only, actually, let me correct that, has mostly taken cases from Minnesota just because they've had such a high volume of these petitions. He's agreed with the federal government stance. And in the specific cases that Judge Hovland and Judge Traynor have ruled on, they've like sort of provided in-depth analyses of like what they think the statute actually says. That's not exactly the case for Judge Welty. So the case he ruled on, he issued an order to grant a request for a bond hearing just because the Department of Justice had actually failed to meet a court-imposed deadline to respond to the lawsuit. And so in his opinion, he indicated that he thought the plaintiff's claims seemed like they had merit, but that really the grounds for him granting the request was just that the Department of Justice hadn't met the deadline that they were supposed to.
Mary, you were telling me offline that in order to research some of these rulings, that you just can't do it online from where you're at. You have to go to a particular place in a courthouse. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so I asked the federal court clerk about this. So she said, if I'm summarizing her correctly, that in certain cases, including some immigration cases and Social Security cases, courts make it a little bit harder for the general public to view documents. And so they're still technically public, but you have to go to a terminal, like a computer, I mean, in the courthouse to view them. And the idea behind that is that these cases are a little bit more sensitive than normal. And so they just put that barrier there so that people can only see them, you know, if they're really looking for them. And so I've had to go to the courthouse, especially probably at least once a day last week. And luckily our office is like really close by. It's like a 2-minute walk. But because these cases are moving so quickly, I really, you know, I would kind of watch the docket like a hawk. And if I saw there was an update, I usually had to like, you know, walk up the street, go through security, ride the elevator up, boot up the terminal to check what was going on.
We're enjoying our conversation with Mary Stoyer in our weekly conversation called A Closer Look with the Monitor. Today, we're talking about immigration enforcement and the growing number of ICE detention cases that are now moving through federal court right here in North Dakota. Of course, Mary, this has impacted communities nationwide and even here in North Dakota. And your reporting includes reactions from attorneys and nonprofit leaders who say fear is growing, even here. What are you hearing from these folks and from their families as well?
I haven't talked to a lot of people directly, although the few conversations I've had with attorneys and people involved with nonprofits that help new Americans, they are saying that even though ICE doesn't really have a very visible presence in North Dakota, certainly like nothing like it is in Minneapolis, that people are seeing what's going on and they're really afraid that they could get targeted. And this was sort of regardless of immigration status is what I heard from some of the people I spoke to, just because there have been reports of people with legal status ending up in detention. And so there's just sort of an overarching atmosphere of fear and uncertainty.
Mary, there are so many elements to a story like this. What surprised you most in your reporting about these ICE detentions that are happening right here, and then these actions that are happening right here in North Dakota?
So one element that I don't think I really had either the space, or maybe it just like wasn't really super relevant to the story, one element that I didn't really address is that in pretty much every case, the plaintiffs were asking the judges to order that they don't be like spirited away to a detention center in another state while the case was pending. And so I really felt kind of the urgency of the cases while I was trying to watch them, just like in, you know, by searching them up in court records. I was surprised by how quickly the attorneys would try to move, like after a detention happened. In some cases, they told me that, you know, they would have to sacrifice a lot of, you know, sleep to make sure that they would get the filing in before their client could potentially be moved to a detention center in like Texas or Louisiana or something. And so, I mean, I had heard that was happening sort of in national media, but just like the pressure, and in some cases, like the impossible demands on some of these attorneys to try to like act quickly enough for their clients, was just very striking to me.
The other thing I wonder about is, as you reported and as you said earlier, there aren't many immigration attorneys that are even there to help. So that makes it even probably more time sensitive for a lot of folks who find themselves in this position.
Yeah, I really didn't know, and I still pretty much know nothing about the immigration system because it's so complex, but I had no reference point for, you know, what a typical immigration attorney does or doesn't do in their day-to-day lives. And so the idea, you know, that there are so few in the state, and they really never have been put in a position to have to know how to do this before, I think was also not necessarily surprising, I suppose, just because, like I said, I have never had to think about it before. The fact that even among the attorneys who do this for a living, you know, they've never had to file these types of lawsuits in federal court. And so they're sort of starting from zero, but taking up a new, you know, an entirely new skill for sure.
And it all needs to happen, as you said, very, very quickly. That's Mary Stoyer. She's a reporter with the North Dakota Monitor. You can read her and her colleagues' awesome reporting on ICE detention cases and many other things about our state government and other legal developments at NorthDakotaMonitor.com. Mary, thank you for helping us take a closer look.
Thank you.
And that's this week's A Closer Look with the Monitor. You can always read the North Dakota Monitor online without paywalls or subscriptions at NorthDakotaMonitor.com.
The Fargo-Moorhead Symphony presents A Night at the Oscars, February 21st at the Fargo Theater. Conducted by Jane Lind Capistran, the program features the FM Choral Artist with music from Oscar-winning films. Information at fmsymphony.org.
This is Main Street on this Giving Hearts Day. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Across the Northern Plains, history isn't always carved in marble. Sometimes it's written in careful handwriting, tucked into folders, and passed quietly from one generation to the next. Today on Plains Folk, Dr. Tom Easern opens a remarkable collection of memories that bring the lives of Prairie Pioneer mothers vividly back into view.
There was supposed to be a dedicated Pioneer Mother Monument on the Capitol grounds in Bismarck. It never happened. Another memorial, one of words, not stone, emerged, the Pioneer Mother Project. A few days ago, I was rummaging through forgotten collections of the Institute for Regional Studies and opened up the records of the Gardar Homemakers Club, an organization, extension-affiliated, of Icelandic rural women in Pembina. Included among the papers is a Pioneer Mothers series. In 1929, the Federated Women's Clubs of North Dakota resolved, first, to emplace a Pioneer Mother statue in Bismarck, and also to gather narrative accounts of Pioneer Mothers defined as here and married before statehood. Local club women were to write about their forebears and, with their typed manuscripts, also send donations for the monument. Not enough donations came in. But in 1932, the Federated Clubs turned over to the State Historical Society a huge collection of narratives in three-ring binders. What I stumbled across in the Gardar collection was the original handwritten manuscripts written by club members, two thick folders of them. They have some common elements. First, all the women treated are Icelandic immigrants. Migration stories figure prominently. Linking Icelandic origins to Canadian stopovers to American settlement in Dakota Territory. Second, there are the begats, Old Testament style, only feminine, assiduous attention to ancestry and descent. The migration stories are fascinating, the lineage not so much, unless it's your own. But then, in some of the handwritten narratives, storytelling takes over, and description. And the reading is compelling. It is worthy of a large public, which is something I'm thinking about. Let me tell you about Mrs. Sigridur Johanna Samuelsdotter Bjarnason, whose story is penned by her granddaughter. This pioneer woman was born in 1848 in Dalasisla, near the Icelandic west coast. Married in 1878 and began her family in a turf house, and came to America in 1883, her second child being delivered at sea by the ship Position. Here is how her loving granddaughter describes her. Mrs. Bjarnason was a small woman, about 5 foot, 2 inches tall. She was considered a beautiful woman in her youth. She had gray eyes, flecked with brown, and luxurious brown hair that did not gray until after 60. She had a very fine mind, and to the last she read voluminously. She had a fine understanding of poetry and knew a great deal of Icelandic poetry by heart, and she instilled early in her children a love of books and cultural things. By herself, she learned to read Danish and Norwegian, and that during the busy years of pioneer struggles. Her eyesight was good, and all her mental faculties alert to the last. She often told of pioneer struggles. The outstanding experience was the terrible smallpox epidemic at Gimli, the first fall, from which 3 of her 4 children died in a week. This pioneer mother didn't just recite the sagas, she lived them.
A monument of stone was never raised, but these stories endure in the memories of families, in the handwritten pages, and in the lives those pioneer mothers shaped. Plainspoke is written and presented by Dr. Tom Ezern of North Dakota State University. Main Street continues on this Giving Hearts Thursday. I'm Craig Blumenschein, live in the Main Street studio, and this is one of those moments where listening can turn into action. And of course, as we've been letting you know, and the state has been letting you know, today is Giving Hearts Day. And while you're hearing us live in real time, you can also respond in real time. That's something most nonprofits don't get to do. We're having a conversation with you right now. And if Prairie Public is part of your daily routine, your morning news, your drive home, your weekend programs, something that keeps you company, today is the day to step forward and support it. Joining me in the Main Street studio is my colleague Eric Dethridge. He's a program manager here. And Eric, folks can visit prairiepublic.org or go to givingheartsday.org and search for Prairie Public.
Yeah. If you go onto our website, you can't miss the Giving Hearts banner. It's right there, front and center. And so many folks, Craig, have been taking us up on this today for Giving Hearts Day. We just can't thank you enough for chipping in. We have a huge goal to raise $500,000 by
Eric,
the end of the day.
Eric, we're on our way. We're
getting
do
there.
This.
We had a good morning, but you know we haven't been talking to you for a few hours, so now it's time to, as they say, get that foot on the gas. Go to prairiepublic.org. Make your donation, which is doubled today, dollar for dollar match, so you can really have an impact for the news, information, and the stories. I mean, the dulcet tones of Tom Ezern. I mean, come on, the lyrical, poetic, storytelling of people and characters in this region. You get that on Dakota Date Book 2, but hearing Tom's essays is always a welcome, warm respite from the workday, that's for sure. And I'm sure you enjoy it. We heard about Icelandics in North Dakota, Mountain North Dakota, because, of course, the epicenter of that. So thanks to Tom for his essays. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your support. When you go to prairiepublic.org, get that gift doubled right now. Thank you to Terry of Moorhead, Donald of Detroit Lakes. Got a lot of Minnesotas today. Diana from Crookston. Got Joel and Kathleen from Bismarck. Beverly from Fargo. Thank you so much. PrairiePublic.org. Make a big impact right now for all the things that you enjoy, that you rely on. We heard a story. You had a great conversation earlier in the hour, Craig, with one of the reporters from the North Dakota Monitor. Love your weekly segments with them. They go deep into issues that are national and regional in nature and sort of boil it down to how it impacts people in North Dakota. And just thinking about like trying to get a lawyer, you're at a disadvantage if you know you don't know the ins and outs of the legal system and you don't speak the language and you don't have natural accesses to attorneys. And
there are many immigration lawyers in this state that can help. And as Mary Stoyer told us, they're kind of learning on the fly, too, in something that matters to people's lives.
Yeah.
And those are the types of stories, Eric, that I'm proud to be able to bring to our listeners here at Prairie Public. And it's so heartwarming to see the lists and lists and lists of people who have given of their hearts today in support of what we do here at Prairie Public. And it's something that is not lost on any of us. I love to go down these lists and be able to look at towns before I have to repeat one, and I can do that here from Fargo to Lemon to Bismarck to Bottineau to Moorhead to Holly to West Fargo to Sheldon to Williston and back to Bismarck. And that's just a small chunk of the list.
Wow. Ray, North Dakota.
There you go.
That's wonderful.
PrairiePublic.org. Still ahead on Main Street, our reminders that today is Giving Hearts Day. And if Prairie Public is a part of your daily life, you can support the programs and conversations you value by giving now at prairiepublic.org or givingheartsday.org. And in just a bit, Thursday's Tech with Peck. We're talking projectors or TVs, plus our weekly visit with the North Dakota Gateway to Science. It's all right after this news. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein on this Giving Hearts Day. One question looms large. What's above that fireplace? Are you using a TV or using a projector? This edition with Tech with Peck, George Peck is going to help us think through, from everyday living rooms to light-controlled theater rooms, what really matters when you're choosing that big screen projector, maybe. George, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you. It's actually an 83-inch LG OLED above the fireplace, gas, not wood, with a mantle in between to make sure that the television doesn't get too hot.
Okay, ours would be a little smaller than that with a mantle in between and an electric fireplace that never gets hot. So there you are. George, let's talk about projectors and let's start simple. When does it make more sense to have a projector rather than a television for you to really enjoy maybe movies and such?
Well, I mean, to me, when I've got a dedicated space, okay, that I can control light in, I think that's a super important thing. So I have it's an unfinished basement, but I just walled it off with black velvet curtains and made it light tight, really, any time of day. And so to me, that's an important consideration for a projector, because if you've got a projector in a living room that's going to have light spilling in from a bunch of windows, it's going to wash that picture out. So you need some form of light control. It doesn't have to be total, but you need to be able to keep light off the screen. So I think that would be rule number one about projector versus television. You got to have a fair amount of space because you're going to want to project on at least 100, probably 110-inch screen. That takes a little space. So if you don't have enough room for 110-inch screen, probably not a good projector application.
Let's get into, George, what type of projectors are available? They've been around for a long time. They've gotten better, and the technology has changed.
So the new thing that I am very curious about and I'm paying a little attention to are what are called lifestyle projectors. And there's a couple of manufacturers. Valerian is the one that comes to mind. I think they started with like a Kickstarter campaign. And the lifestyle projector is designed to be a little more casual. It's a little lighter. You don't have to mount it to the ceiling or mount it. You can carry it around. I'm thinking about a lifestyle projector. Well, I was looking online today at various lifestyle projector articles, and one said, best projector for camping. I kind of chuckled, a projector for camping. So what I'm thinking about maybe is a projector for outdoor movies during the summer. Get a big outdoor kind of a screen. You can get these like inflatable, big, huge screens. And then a lifestyle projector that's light, and you can take it outside and plug it in and watch a movie outside. You got to bring the mosquito repellent yourself, but the projector's got even sound built in. So lifestyle projector is one option, but I'm still sticking with a more traditional projector that I mount on the ceiling. It's a dedicated fixed installation, and it's because I really want the best possible picture. So that's the route I'm still going, is a traditional home theater dedicated projector. Different, by the way, than one you might see in the boardroom at your company, because business projectors are not designed to do good video. They're designed to show a computer screen.
What's the difference, George?
So the difference is video processing, generally, and to a certain extent, size. And so the business projectors are smaller. Dedicated home theater projectors tend to be a little bit larger. But just the ability to process video and not just computer screens makes the big difference.
I'll add that I have a short throw laser projector in my home. It can create a very large image. Mine is projected to a 120-inch screen, and it's only 11.5 inches away from the wall, but it does sit on the floor right in front of my very large screen. I added that, George, because when we were designing our home, I didn't want anything to hang off the ceiling because we had some other things going on in the room. And so we chose to do it this way. It does take up a little bit of space in front of the projector. We have to worry about grandkids running around and jostling against it, but it seems to work well for us.
You know, and we've talked about it, and I've never actually seen a short throw projector, and I'm very curious how they work, because you've got a projector on the floor or below the screen, just a few inches away, shining up.
Right.
Physically, there's got to be some fairly fascinating video processing that makes the top of that screen a whole lot brighter than the bottom, because otherwise you would see this huge flare at the bottom. So technically, I'm very curious how they work. I just haven't had an opportunity to see one.
Well, I hope you can get up to the frozen north here, George, someday.
No, we'll have to wait till it's 20 below.
And I'll come take watch a look at ours. All right, you talked earlier about what kind of room really benefits from a projector, and we touched on this last week. George, are you a fan of long, skinny rooms, of square rooms? What's your thought there? And again, it probably depends on the projector you have.
Well, I think it's not, I mean, that's part of it, but I think it might be the other way around, that the projector, to a certain extent, would depend on the room you have. So a room and a projector need to kind of go together in that a projector needs a certain throw distance to the screen. And different projectors have different throw distances. And some projectors have limited zoom capabilities. Some have very, very flexible zoom capabilities. Some have what's called lens shift, and that determines how much you have to go up and down to have the projector match the screen. And all those things go into play when you determine the type of room it's going to go in. So if you've got a projector with a very long throw distance, you're going to have a fairly long room to accommodate it, especially if you have a big screen. So it all kind of goes together based on the room you have, the size screen you want, and those things kind of come together to determine the combination of the room and the projector.
George, big TVs, we've got to talk about those because really they have fallen in price. There are different qualities of very large televisions. Has that changed the projector conversation?
If I was a projector manufacturer, I'd probably be a little nervous because I'm now seeing, I mean, you and I both have a 120-inch screen. I'm trying to remember what, I think TCL is releasing now, selling 116-inch, like a LCD television. And so over 100-inch televisions are now becoming fairly common. They're not becoming necessarily super inexpensive, but they're dropping in price to where they're getting close to some projector pricing. So, yeah, it's becoming more of an option for you if you want to get away from a projector and still have a really big screen.
How does that connect, though, to a sound system? And of course, mine uses HDMI with eARC. George, you want to explain what that is?
Well, so HDMI is High Definition Multimedia Interface, is what it stands for, and it's a video standard. But you also carry audio on the same cable. So rather than having separate audio and video cables, and like you did in the old days, the whole audio-video combination goes down one HDMI cable. Ultimately, in a higher-end theater like I have an HDMI cable going from my video sources, my Blu-ray or whatever, into a processor. The processor then sends audio to amplifiers to all my speakers and then a separate video-only output to my projector. Now, televisions have audio built in, where you get a sound bar to go with a television, and then you can hear me whine about sound bars in another segment. So you can have audio that's part of the television. You can have audio that's part of a lifestyle projector. But to me, again, if we go back to my original contention that home theater is to mimic that theater experience, the audio needs to be separate and needs to be a little bit better than you're going to get out of a projector.
George, as we kind of wind things up here, relative to the television discussion, do people underestimate how bright modern TVs are compared to projectors, or can projectors compete in that realm?
Not yet. So that's another reason why if you are considering a projector, you want some light control, because if you take a projector and put it in a really bright room against a screen, you can mitigate it somewhat with these ambient light reducing screens. There's certain screens you can buy that have some ambient light reduction, but you're never going to get the brightness you get with a television, especially with something called HDR, which is a high dynamic range, bright feature of 4K video. So if you take a projector and a TV, you're going to always, not always, but almost universally get a much brighter picture from a television. So it's more appropriate for a room with ambient light. Don't have as much light control. You will have much better luck with a brighter television than a projector.
That's George Peck. He helps us demystify what home theater really means and why better doesn't always mean bigger, and why newer or more expensive is something worth talking about. George joins us every Thursday in this segment we call Tech with Peck. And George, next week, we're going to get into the tech jargon of picture display, 4K, you've said OLED, There's QLED. There's lots of other tech jargon things we need to dissect when it comes to picture quality. Thanks for joining us again on Main Street.
All right, man. Looking forward to next week.
This is Craig Blumenschein, live in the Main Street studio. And let me ask you a simple question. What's it worth to have a place for thoughtful conversation, local reporting, music that surprises you, and voices that you trust? Well, that's us. That's what Prairie Public delivers. That's what we try to deliver every single day. And on Giving Hearts Day, you get to decide what that's worth to you. And if it matters, act on it. Go to prairiepublic.org or Giving Hearts Day and search Prairie Public. Eric, we have so much to be thankful here at Prairie Public. My friend Eric Dethridge, he's our program manager here, is with me in the Main Street studio.
Oh, yeah. Lots to be thankful for. Well, thankful for you listening to the show right now. You are what matters. You are the person we're talking to on this Giving Hearts Day, and you can make a big impact for Prairie Public. Yes, our federal funding has been cut. You've heard about that. Yes, we set an ambitious goal for Giving Hearts Day this year, $500,000. I mean, that's off the charts big as far as a goal. Now, the response has been incredible so far. Before the day even began, folks like you have totaled now in gifts $225,000. That's more than 500 donations that have already come in, and we're adding to that as we go along today. And that's telling us something very powerful, Craig, that this community believes in public media. But you know what? We still have a long way to go. The day is getting a little bit long in the tooth here. But we are still here with news, music, information, and education that you count on every day. Help us close the gap. Give now at prairiepublic.org.
Now, the great thing about Prairie Public, Eric, is we have no paywall.
Right.
We require no subscriptions. Everyone has access. The reason is, well, because everybody steps up. Your gift helps local programs like Main Street stay strong, and it's much appreciated. We have independent journalism that requires independent funding. Every gift, even modest gifts, make a difference. And Eric, I think the numbers are even higher than that. And in a most recent email that I received, we're over $300,000.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Let's update those numbers as much as we can. Yeah, no, they've been pouring in, Craig. And, you know, we just got to keep that momentum going if we have a chance of making this $500,000 goal. And remember, your gift, if you're just joining us, is being matched today, dollar for dollar. PrairiePublic.org. Open up that Giving Hearts banner. It's front and center and prominent. You know, all the ways you listen to Prairie Public, through the app, smart speaker, the streaming on the web, the radio, all the towers and transmitters across this region, all of that costs money. We're a non-commercial station. Our federal funding has been cut. The bulk of our support has always been listeners like you, but now that's like, you know, almost 100% so. So right now, take a little bit of action. You'll get your gift boosted dollar for dollar. PrairiePublic.org. Open that big Giving Hearts banner.
There's been a great momentum here with Giving Hearts Day. Eric, we've talked about many organizations and have supported them who are also asking for Giving Hearts dollars. And the beauty is you don't have to pick just one. If you're supporting the food bank, if you're supporting the North Dakota Monitor or the Gateway to Science, you can also choose Prairie Public at PrairiePublic.org.
Yeah, Giving Hearts Day is really awesome. This whole season of generosity is just great.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for The Middle Live. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we're checking in again today. This is Thursday, of course, with North Dakota's Gateway to Science. Hope Brodolsky is a STEM education specialist. Hope, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you for having me.
The North Dakota Gateway to Science, like so many great nonprofits across the state here in North Dakota, including us here at Prairie Public, is taking part in Giving Hearts Day. What does that mean to Gateway to Science?
Well, Giving Hearts Day is one of my favorite holidays because I believe that everybody should have a giving heart. And so with North Dakota's Gateway to Science, we are really using Giving Hearts Day to focus on expanding our outreach and making sure it is equitable for all across the state. And so for any funds that we are raising this year, we are specifically putting it towards all travel costs so that that doesn't have to fall on the schools. And so we can come to a Bismarck school as well as a school, say, in Lignite, North Dakota, and it would be the exact same cost so that we don't have to charge that extra piece. So it's much more equitable for our schools across the state.
Hope, give us an understanding about what you do when you work with outreach, where, why you go to schools, what you do while you're there, and why this is so important, not just for the Gateway to Science per se in Bismarck, but for everywhere in North Dakota.
Well, our outreach is so cool because we can do a lot of really great things that can be specialized for each school. So some of our main pieces that we do with outreach is workshops, and we have a wide variety that all align to North Dakota state standards. And so as we come into a classroom, we are also able to talk to those teachers, see how they can assess, and then use that to be a part of their classroom assessment. One of my favorites that we get to teach is called What's the Matter? And so we get to teach typically K through two about the states of matter in chemistry. But that's just one little piece that we do. We also do a program called a STEM Zone, which is a carnival setup, usually in a gym or a library space. And we bring 10 hands-on activities that all relate to different careers. So kids actually get to get their hands dirty. They get to become the career. And hopefully that's where they get to have that spark. We also have a new program that we are deploying this year with our Digitalis Dome, which is an inflatable planetarium. And we have over 17 shows that we are able to do with a wide variety of age ranges. And we can fit up to 30 to, if we put them close, 45 kids in a setting. And so it's a really cool experience because in North Dakota, we have very few planetariums. To my knowledge, we have one in Valley City, and then we have something like it at UND. And so being able to bring it to schools makes the world of difference because oftentimes they don't have something like that in their communities. We are on the road probably 4 out of 5 days of the work week, and we also are working on weekends. We're doing events. We are doing community events. One of my favorites is when we partner with the North Dakota Petroleum Foundation. We get to go to their Bakken Cook Fest every year, and that's usually during a weekday, but then also we've done weekend events too. So we are constantly traveling, ensuring that we can get STEM across the entire state.
Okay, so how can folks participate?
With givingheartsday.org, you can choose which charity you want to donate to. You are also able to make a charitable donation here at North Dakota's Gateway to Science. And we are doing a campaign where you can write your name on a heart so you can get that beautiful recognition, because we want to show off our giving hearts in our communities, and we really want to recognize the people that are supporting our mission.
That's Hope Berdalski. She's a STEM education specialist at North Dakota's Gateway to Science. Of course, we've been talking about Giving Hearts Day all day long here at Prairie Public. And Hope has been talking about how Giving Hearts also supports North Dakota's Gateway to Science. They travel across the state almost every day during the school year here in North Dakota. Hope, thanks so much for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you.
This is Dakota Daybook for February 12th. In the early 20th century, automobile makers understood the value of presenting new cars as entertainment. Farmers shopping for new equipment at farm shows and women seeking the latest household conveniences couldn't help but be drawn to highly polished automobiles and acres of shining chrome. On this date in 1917, the Grand Forks Herald announced that Grand Forks was becoming the foremost automobile city in North Dakota as residents took to the roads and the city saw a significant increase in the number of cars. The newspaper attributed the growth to miles of paved streets, calling them the best roads on which to enjoy a spin in a motor car. The city also boasted several garages with experienced mechanics who could furnish every assistance to the motorist in trouble. Manufacturers took notice and announced plans to hold an auto show in the city. Car makers actively courted new customers, encouraging farmers to recognize the convenience of the automobile. North Dakota is a sprawling state, and cars made it possible to cover long distances in a much shorter time. Farmers were reminded that the automobile offered a rapid, comfortable, and efficient means of transportation. Those living on isolated farms could more easily visit neighbors and make more frequent trips to town. Potential buyers were assured they would not be disappointed by the variety of vehicles on display. The Saxon Motor Car Company, known for its affordable models, planned to show several cars. The conventional touring car and four-seat roadster sold for $895. The basic roadster sold for $495, the equivalent of about $13,800 today. Several other dealers were also expected to attend. The auto show was about more than automobiles. It was designed as a full entertainment venue to draw crowds and attract buyers. It was billed as the best auto show that has ever been held in the state of North Dakota. The Grand Forks Military Band and guest performers would appear each evening. A curling tournament was scheduled during the week, and visitors could also watch famous ski jumpers compete in a ski tournament. It promised to be an exciting week in Grand Forks. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
We'll just carry on that underwriter spot, Eric, and support for Prairie Public is from our listeners.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by you.
That's right. It's our listeners who are already part of this. They may not realize it. You may not realize it. But you're listening right now. You're part of our family here at Prairie Public, and you shape what we're all about just by simply tuning in, by listening to us on a live stream, listening to us over the radio, however you choose to listen to us. We're grateful, but Giving Hearts Day is why we're here. This is the last time this hour that Eric and I will be with you, for you to give us a dollar, and we'll match it for a dollar. Give us more, we'll match it. If you value being part of our community, then help sustain it. Not someday, Eric, not eventually.
Right now.
Today.
Now's the time.
Today, right now. Prairie Public or givingheartsday.org. Search for us and then give from the heart.
Yeah, give from the heart. I mean, that's what it's all about. That's what we're trying to reach today, is your heart. You know, I think your brain would tell you, too, that giving to public radio is a great investment, and you get awesome return on it. You get just so much fact-driven news, which we need right now in our democracy, as just fewer and fewer sources of information and journalism are at our fingertips these days. I was just reading about the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette about to go out of business, and of course we heard about the cuts at the Washington Post. Yep. It's very important that we support those journalistic institutions that are still doing great work. There's lots of awesome papers and publications in North Dakota and Minnesota worth supporting. Prairie Public is on the front lines, too, of journalism. We cover North Dakota on the radio very vigorously. You trust Dave Thompson and his team to bring you the stories. You trust Craig to have thoughtful, thought-provoking conversations with newsmakers and artists here in the state. PrairiePublic.org. It's a dollar-for-dollar match. Just open that Giving Hearts Day banner and big bright lights and be counted, be included right now.
If you're donating, you're investing in civic life. It's pretty much that simple. And your donation allows us to continue on strongly. We're not impacted, or we have been impacted by cuts, but we're not going to die from it. We're going to march forward with strength, and you're a part of that. Your Giving Hearts Day donation that will match dollar for dollar. You'll help us reach our $500,000 goal. That seems like a lot, but we lost a lot and we're regaining it now. And we are forever thankful for all of the listeners who have supported Prairie Public.
Like Brian of Rugby, like Georgianne of Dickinson, David of Bismarck, Terry and Molly of Grand Forks, an anonymous listener. Thank you. You don't have to give your name if you don't want to. We'd love to shout it out if we can. PrairiePublic.org.
Eric, I was interviewed by Wyoming Media before the start of their legislative session this year, and I was asked a question by a journalist in Wyoming, Samuel Western, on the difference between Wyoming and North Dakota.
Hmm.
And I summed it up this way. Today, Wyoming sees its stewardship as withdrawal, and North Dakota sees its stewardship as engagement. I firmly believe that. Engage today. support Prairie Public. As we wrap up today's Main Street on this Giving Hearts Day, we want to thank you for listening and for being part of what makes Prairie Public possible. Every conversation we share, every story we tell, every moment of connection on the air exists because people like you believe public media matters. Today is a powerful reminder that strong communities are built through shared support, and that includes the programs you rely on here every day. If Prairie Public informs you, inspires you, or simply keeps you company, we hope you'll take a moment to give from the heart. Just visit prairiepublic.org or go to givingheartsday.org and search for Prairie Public. Thanks for being here. Thanks for caring. And thanks for supporting public media.